Accession number 30493, reel 13.
From Grey, reel 13.
Yes. Well, I've just recently dipped into a book, which is a pretty good book, The Sharp End, World War II, The Sharp End, by John Ellis. And it's a very thorough book. And it's a uniquely detailed and accessible study of the actual human experience of the Allied front soldier in World War II. Well, I've had dipped it into it in the past, but I've just read this extraordinary passage. It's Patriotism, Politics and Boredom. Now, I mean, I've gone on quite a bit about boredom and a little bit about patriotism. He says, nominally, World War II was an overtly ideological struggle. The forces of democracy ranged against the evils of fascism. It is not my concern here to assess the extent to which this was the case, but to try and gauge how far the troops themselves bothered with such concepts. Well, I mean, here's a guy here who bothered with concepts. And he says, a few might be swept along by high-flown sentiments and volunteer for military service. But once they got to the front line, there was simply no place for such generalisation. Now, to talk about generalisation, generalities. I couldn't disagree more. The world became reduced to a company or a troop, and the only important thing in life was the chances of preserving one's own. Yes, of course. But, he says, the enemy was bullets, shells, grenades, dugouts and bunkers, occasionally an actual German or Japanese soldier. And the struggle against these was all too all-consuming to allow of irrelevant flannel about just wars. Now, my diary is full of entries about what kind of war this is, you know, or the good of humanity. That in the pages of my war diary, I show a great deal of concern for humanity. It's evident on every other page. So he couldn't have met anybody like me, it seems. And he wrote this big book, which is actually an excellent book on the whole. Then the funny thing is, a photo gives lie. It gives lie to that argument, because here is a photograph, and it's a soldier is lying on his back outside his truck here, and he's enjoying a book he's reading. And what do you think it's called? Plans for a Better World. That was written by Smuts, of course, of South Africa, who brought South Africa into the war on our side, although half the population were rooting for the Nazis. We know that now. So, but later on, he does ponder on the fact this army that he says was not concerned with generalities and flannel about politics. Then on page 321, he says, there still remains a suspicion that it was the army vote that was responsible for the surprise defeat of Churchill in the 1945 election. And he says, it is difficult to ascertain the truth of this, but he didn't speak up and talk to enough soldiers. Although it is known that 60% of the forces did vote in this election, an extraordinarily high number, considering the bureaucratic difficulties and the passive obstruction of the military authorities. Then he says, for many officers, the final result quite took the edge off the military victory. There we are. Now, that's in my diary, I talk about this class division that was so evident in the army. And here in this book, he's saying how disappointed the officers were when the men voted for Labour government. It's strange that he should have written this book and not been more. Then there's this question of ABCA pops up. In some circles, it was felt necessary to apportion blame, and a prime whipping boy was the Army Education Corps. Now, that's in my diary. The fact that I think it is that the influence of ABCA, at least I've talked to you about it, which had conducted current affairs seminars and issued its own teaching aid, The British Way and Purpose, for its hundreds of supposedly left-wing instructors. In fact, it is impossible to judge what the effects of these classes were, though for myself, I would eschew any theory so offensively patronising as to suggest that the ordinary soldier was not capable of making up his own mind about issues. Well, there, at least that does conflict with a lot of entries in my war diary, and I've just discovered that this morning.
Did you find that the education board seemed fairly left wing?
Well, I mean, it's peculiar to say, even use the word left wing, because it was just in the popular consciousness by then. I mean, most people knew that the Conservative Party had opposed Churchill. I mean, the Conservative Party adopted Churchill suddenly, but I suppose 90% of Conservatives were against Churchill because the policy was peace. Neville Chamberlain appeasing Hitler all those years. And I think there was a massive sense of blame. It might not have been very well informed, but my God, this great army with British people were sent out to fight in a war, and a Conservative government had done nothing to stop Hitler coming to power. I mean, how can we not have known about that? Not, as I say, on a well-informed level, which we have today with a great library of books depicting the history of those years, but it came filtered through, and although we're really happy to follow Churchill as a war leader, we had no intention of asking him to lead us in peacetime. But the officer class did. I mean, I guess what 90% of them. There's always a minority everywhere, isn't there? Or on the other side, so to speak. And I think there were sympathetic officers. Some officers had made it from the working class and into the ranks of the privileged few who bossed us about all those years. I came across a passage in my diary which our estimation of officers is made very, very clear. A new officer came in. We were moved to one particular site in the mountains, and very isolated. And for some reason or other, briefly, we had this other officer, strange officer, turn up and run the unit. And we called him Burglar Bill. Pretty soon, you could tell whether an officer was popular. He could have Wigginton, Lieutenant Wigginton became Wiggy, which is a sort of an affectionate title. We saw him every day. And he was killed, of course, in an observation post. We had great respect for him. An officer had to earn the respect of the men, you know. Otherwise, there'd be this. You couldn't show it. You couldn't show that you despised them or even hated them. They were your had total authority over you. But it was quickly evident in the attitude of the men, whether they favoured their officer or regarded him as a bastard, you know. And guide to how what you thought of an officer was his nickname. Now, Burglar Bill was really an epithet, you know. And he was strutting round. There we were, an isolated unit in the mountains, not a lot to do, but we had to protect this valley. And it was very rocky, you couldn't dig very easily. And in fact, we'd had rudimentary trenches, and one day he just went round barking, fill all those holes, they're not necessary. And so we filled these holes in. A week later, he was saying, "Where are your slit trenches? Where are your slit, get your slit trenches?" I mean, the absurdity of the man. There was another officer who we didn't have much respect for. Now, because they had Batman, you see, that's. Now, the fact that an officer has a servant, that made him into a different class altogether. You know, if you were a private or an infantryman, a gunner, a signaller, you didn't have any stripes up, and you didn't want any, then you looked at your officers very critically indeed. After all, they had the question of life or death over you, really.
What qualities made for a good officer?
A good officer, well, one who talked to his men, above all. And as I say, it was Monty who really forced that on the army, I think, when we were facing total defeat in the desert, North Africa. Monty came along and just imbued the army, I think. I don't know what the experts and historians are saying today, but that's the feeling he gave to the men. That's the important thing. Whatever the truth was... I mean, he was Monty. We know he was arrogant, egoistic, but that's perhaps what generals have to be to get where they get to. An officer has to talk to his men and pass on information. What you desperately need, there you are. You know, you're part of this vast army. I mean, there's this tremendous conflict going on in the world. Between, I mean, if you were politically aware, you knew it was a fascist world that you were in uniform to prevent, you know. A lot of us knew that. And we wanted information about how it was going along. Now, there was a radio, there was an army radio that gave information. The BBC, you could tune into. There was the army newspaper. The rest was what information you could get from newspapers or magazines or letters sent from home. But that was the only way an officer could win respect, I think. Also, he showed in a tricky situation. That he showed a bit of courage. And the officers that had to go up to the observation post, well, they had to at least acquire bravery. We respected them by the very fact that they were up there and liable to be shot at, very highly liable to be injured or killed. And that's where the respect arose. But there we are, communication I'd put absolutely essential. And Sean Montgomery started that. It's a shocking class division, you know. It does show up in this book, The Sharp End, but it shows up, but he's quite aware of the extent of it in the armed forces. Is it any different today? I doubt it very much. I don't know. More officers come up from the ranks, perhaps, than they used to. But then I'm not very well informed. in that area.
Were there differences in, or did you have did you have any experience of officers who'd come up through the ranks?
I don't know. I don't think so. No. They all seemed to, you know, they thought, of course it was a question of accent, wasn't it, really? You had a certain accent, you were an officer. I think I learned to speak English a little more, what shall I say, more clearly. And I remember once or twice I was mistaken for an officer, so my my way of speaking may have not been, you know, a soldier's speech. I mean, I had to be sort of in a truck and calling out from the truck, "Are we okay for Div headquarters?" "Yes, sir." So, whether it was just my steel spectacles, or but there was that gulf, really. No doubt about it.
In terms of the non-commissioned officers,
NCOs, there again, you could be popular NCO or a hated NCO. It was difficult for it was difficult for anyone to love a sergeant major, I can tell you, with him barking orders at you all the time. But usually behind that authoritarian, aggressive, loud and unpleasant attitude from sergeant majors, sometimes you found, you know, you felt it was a front, and that, you know, basically they were okay, decent guys. But it was all the shouting and the bullying that went on sometimes, and you did hate the sergeant majors, really. Now, lower down, the sergeant, well, each gun had a sergeant on it, and in a way, by working with him constantly, he earned your respect, I think. And then, of course, the bombardiers, or the lance bombardiers, you have a sergeant, usually, on a gun. Three of them would be NCOs. I mean, there'd be the sergeant, number one, there'd be the bombardier, that's two stripes, and the lance bombardier, one stripe. And so you'd be all living together. I mean, you'd be in the same tent. So the stripes in action disappeared. You were just six guys on a gun, part of a team. A battery of four guns in a regiment, which consists of three batteries and four guns. That's a dozen guns. And the whole regiment would move as one man in an emergency or in a crisis or a rush to a new position. So it was all teamwork. And in the teamwork, this I say the distinction disappeared. But not with the officers, because most of the officers, well, you didn't see them most of the time. There's no room for this sort of human relationship. It's shocking, really, isn't it? After all, you're all facing the same enemy and all expecting secretly that one shell will come your way one day at any moment. So you had, your trust was forced on you, there's no doubt about it, in the front line. You had to trust everybody. And you tried to trust your officers, because if they made mistakes, then we'd all suffer.
In terms of the regiment as a whole, what was there in the way of a specific regimental pride or spirit?
Well, now, you see, there again, you see, it's the officer class that works hard at that. They couldn't ever let us forget that we were the Kent Yeomanry. Now, what did that mean to soldiers who've been civilians in the 30s? We're supposed to be proud to be in the Kent Yeomanry. No, it was a handful of officers who were Kent men. They had relations with the I don't know. I've got the history of the regiment. I perhaps should read about the early years. But they're very proud of this Kent Yeoman who go back, you know, to 3 centuries, I think. The officer class always loves this ancient history of the unit they were in. But to us guys who've just been either called up or the tiny handful of volunteers like me, didn't mean a thing, not a bloody thing. But when we all paraded together, especially when reached the point where we're all very well trained, you know, and then there was a sense that, you know, we're part of something bigger, you know, that we weren't just a gun team or a battery, but we were a regiment. And when you see us all lined up and all our guns shining and us all spick and span and our Kent Yeomanry initials and the badge all shining bright in the sun, I suppose there was a little stirring of regimental pride, you know. It came after, you know, months and months and years of being together. It had to happen in some way. You became a big family. You know, your family had been left behind. You weren't part of a community. You were your village or your town or your clubs, your local pubs. All that was gone in the past. Something else to take its place. So it had to be this comradeship sense of being together and part of something bigger. It was absolutely essential for morale. Otherwise, we'd have gone to pieces. We were close to going to pieces sometimes, you know. It does show up in my diary.
And did that sense of family have, and going back to the subject of motivation, did that have any influence on the day-to-day motivation of the soldiers?
I can't really speak for other people, can I? Yeah, I mean, I have to admit, I was a bit of a freak, you know, and I'm amazed that I wasn't made the butt of jokes. And I can only put that down to the fact that I was as fit as anybody in the regiment. It's not boasting. In Cyprus, I used to volunteer for things in the army, just as I said before, I think, out of sheer boredom. Sometimes it was quite stupid. I think my first 2 weeks in the army, on Salisbury Plain, I was so bored out of my mind. And the idiotic training we were getting, you know, with bayonets fitted, no modern guns in sight. I volunteered for the I said they wanted volunteers for the paratroops. That was an idiotic. Here I was in the artillery because I was scared stiff of being an infantry man. And a month in the army, something like that. And I was volunteering for the paratroops. Oh, thank God they said, you're not fit enough, you've got glasses, you know. So that was out. But on Cyprus, well, I think we were less bored then. No, the boredom follows you around. I just said, it's a tough tactics training course. Anybody? I put my hand up, so I was in this tough training course on Cyprus, and I was the only one from Hell Richmond, as far as I know. And chaps who volunteered turned out to be all the others on the training course. Turned out to be physical training, PT instructors. So here I was among all these PT instructors, the only gunner, and we did the court tough tactics course, things like leaping over barbed wire and clambering over all kinds of obstacles and doing these long marches and runs. And being instructed in dirty tactics. Now, I've got a marvellous dirty tactics story to tell you. We were trained how quickly to kill somebody by the PT in the chap running the Tough Tactics course, and I learned how to kill somebody very quickly who attacked me. Certain basic tricks, you might say, of killing. And one day, a few years ago here in the car park, a guy who was drunk, it turns out, and was known to the police, he followed me home in his car. Further down the road, I'd simply tooted my horn because he passed me and two buses on the wrong side of the road at the dangerous corner at the end of the road there. And anyway, he followed me into the car park, and I sat in the car, and he was just sitting in his car. And I, stupid of me, I should have just locked the doors and waited for him to get bored. But I got out of the car, and he got out of the car, and he came up to me and started shouting, abusing me. He's obviously drunk. And he suddenly attacked me, knocked my spectacles off first, sent my spectacles flying across the car park, and grabbed me, and we fell to the ground. And I thought, my Tough Tactics. Suddenly, part of my mind was saying, hurt him quickly. And I knew how to hurt him quickly. He's got his hands around my neck, you know. So I put my hands up. All this, I've been trained for 50 years before to do this. And I began to do it automatically. I got hold of his little fingers, and my Tough Tactics experience was saying, snap his little fingers. The pain with him is so awful, he's taken his hand away from me, and it wouldn't have been a fit state, really, to do anything else, perhaps. Then another voice sprang up in my head at the same time, saying, "Hey, you're not a soldier anymore. This guy isn't out to kill you. Don't do it." And I didn't. He was shrieking at me, "Have you had enough? Have you had enough? Have you had enough?" I said, "Yep, I've had enough." He let me get up. And the reason I didn't take a police action against him, he walked across the car park, picked up my spectacles and gave them back to me. So it's an example of sort of army training sort of suddenly emerging all those years later. It's remarkable, isn't it? Anyway, I completed the Tough Tactics course, and I was in the top two or three to complete it. Extraordinary. Because I was just so bloody fit, really. I mean, I was fit before I went into the army, and so many guys weren't. I recognise that.